Hello, it's Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Hello, everybody. Sorry we're a little late, as we do occasionally. We do have technical problems, and this one was really weird because my guest and I were on the phone probably 20 minutes before showtime, and everything was fine. And today, when we tried to get him, his phone wasn't working. But we are going to have an interesting discussion, and you know, this all started for me when I first started doing my genealogy 20-some-odd years ago, and too long to count. And when I started researching one of my family lines, I realized that the family originated in Spain and somehow ended up in Riga, in Latvia, and came to America in the 1840s by way of Veracruz, Mexico. And they settled in New Orleans and then migrated over to Galveston, which is where they really spent most of their time. But as I began to do research, I began to see that my great-grandfather spent a lot of time down in Mexico. He was a ice merchant, and he evidently took his four-wheel wagon with laden with hay and ice blocks and brought them down to Matamoros. So it really kind of interested me because working in Houston, Texas at the time, and that was back when my hair was black, if a lot of you can probably relate to that, I'd get in an elevator and people would start talking to me in Spanish. And I would look at them and I would say, no habla español. And it always, you know, I was always curious, you know, why did they think that, you know, I spoke Spanish and I didn't. And as I began to do my research, I began to realize that, you know, I probably had a lot of Spanish blood in me from way back when. And what really interested me was when I started doing genealogy and I found our guest and some of the work that he has been doing, I got very, very interested in this whole concept of what happened to the Jews of Spain after they left Spain during the Inquisition. And what I began to realize is that a lot of the Spanish Jews left Spain and they came into Mexico. And from Mexico, they migrated here into some of the southwest states of the United States. So I met our guest, Dr. Stan Hortus, about as many years ago as I started doing my research, it seems. And he is the adjunct professor, a research professor at the Latin American and Iberian Institute at the University of New Mexico. He received his BA in history from University of Maryland in 1971, his MA in Latin American history from University of New Mexico in 1973, and his PhD from my hometown, Tulane University, 1980. His doctoral dissertation, which I think is what is really of key interest, is called The Crypto-Jewish Community of New Spain, 1620-1649, a collective biography. And this was based on his research that he conducted in the archives of Mexico and Spain and supported by a Fulbright Dissertation Fellowship. And one of the things that has come out of all of his work over these many years is his new book, which was published by the Columbia University Press in 2005, and it's called To the End of the Earth, A History of the Crypto-Jews of New Mexico. It's a must-read. So, Stanley, welcome.
Thank you, and thank you for the plug.
Well, we go back a long way, I'm afraid. I keep talking to guests, and we keep saying, we go back a long way. And I guess
right,
we start talking.
At least you had hair that was that turned color. I lost all mine.
Oh, you did you?
Yeah, I'm looking for it. I can't seem to find it.
Oh. Well, I went blonde, so I'm no longer have black hair. In any event, yes, it goes back. We go back a long way. I got very interested, Stanley, in your research, and I believe I attended, and I think it was the first workshop or seminar that you hosted both in, I think it was in Phoenix and in Tucson, on the Society for Crypto Jews.
Right.
And that was how long ago?
Well, as I recall, you were at the first meeting that we ever had that was in Rancho State House, were you not, in 1991?
Or, yes, I was.
Yeah, so that goes back almost 20 years now.
20?
And it's 20 years, almost 20 years, if you can believe
yes.
it.
It's hard to believe.
And, yeah, and that was when we were kind of exploring the possibility of forming some sort of organization where we could gather together once a year, and all the people who have been studying the phenomenon of crypto-Judaism from various geographical and disciplinary perspectives, asking ourselves, was it worthwhile to form yet another academic organization where people can meet and discuss their work? And the answer on the part of those 35 or 40 people that were there at the beginning was absolutely. And I think the very next year we held our meeting in San Antonio, Texas, and we had about 150 people there, and we were just amazed that not only were the scholars turning out, but there was a fair representation on the part of the descendants of the Spanish and Portuguese crypto Jews themselves, who were just eager to learn as much as they could about their background, as well as to dialogue with each other and see what people had in common with each other. And the organization has grown, and to the point where we have a couple of hundred members, and we meet on an annual basis every August. And this year we're going to be meeting in San Antonio, Texas, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, which is a Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday.
Well, that is almost a skipping hop for me. So maybe I will come join you this year.
Well, terrific. We'd love to see you. It's been a very long time.
It really has. Probably too long. I got sidetracked, I guess, in my process. So, you know, sometimes it's good to come back to your roots.
It's easy to do.
Let's talk a little bit, Stan. I know when I was at that meeting, and you know, we went through some of the cemeteries and talked to some of the people that were living in New Mexico 20 odd years ago. You know, there were so many things that really lead one to believe that, you know, this is real. I mean, there's no question about it. I remember going into some of the cemeteries and talk to the audience a little bit about some of the customs and some of the things that you all have uncovered, you know, in New Mexico, Arizona, and those areas, maybe even here in Texas.
Well, after 500 some years of keeping secret, the secrecy has become part of the religion itself. And after 500 years, this cultural remnant that comes down to us, After all these years and all these generations, as you might expect, this cultural remnant is going to span quite a broad scope, all the way from people with no practices and no consciousness, nothing that's left but a bloodline and a tendency to contract certain autoimmune diseases that show up more frequently in the Jewish population than general population, and hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit later in the hour. Ranging from people with no consciousness and no practices to people who still today talk about their grandmothers lighting candles on Friday night, having no idea about any connection between what their family customs represent and the phenomenon of how Jews welcome and observe the Sabbath today, to people who still, for whatever reason, abstain from eating pork and they don't mix milk products and meat products at the same meal. And they do these things apparently without being aware of any connection between what they do and the Jewish dietary laws, the laws of Kashrut, to people who still give Jewish biblical names to their children, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rachel, Rebecca, and do these things apparently without being aware of the long tradition that Jews have had to engage in similar naming patterns, to people who still circumcise their male children shortly after birth, and have done so long before the doctors were coming through the Southwest telling everyone that it had to be done for hygienic reasons. And apparently these people continue these practices without being aware of the absolute requirement in Judaism to circumcise one's child on the eighth day after birth. So ranging from these people with no practices and no consciousness to people who still do these things and have no idea why they do them, ranging from them to people who know exactly who they are, whose grandfather might have taken them into the fields when he was 14, 15 years old, saying to him, "Sabes, viejito, que en realidad no somos cristianos, somos judíos. You must understand, my child, we're not Christians, we're really Jews." But at the same time, he says, "You must make certain that no one in the community knows who we are, because you'll put the family at great risk if anyone finds out." But at the same time, he says, "You must pass these traditions on to your children." So here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, still dealing with this very broad range in terms of practice and consciousness.
You know, it is amazing. And you've had an opportunity, I'm sure, to, over these many years, to meet and talk to many of these, individuals. And I remember back, when we first met that, some of the reasons that people were, quote unquote, coming out of the closet, I guess is one way to put it, is because of the media and the fact that, we had television in the homes and people were beginning to see, Jewish customs on television and mm-hmm. saying, "Oh my, we do that." And, "Oh my, we do that." And,
but it's interesting that you bring that up. I'm sorry, let me let you finish your question.
No, I'm done.
Okay. It's interesting that you bring up the whole issue of the media because when, very early on, I started collaborating with some of my colleagues down at the University of New Mexico, Tomas Atencio in the field of sociology, and Rowena Rivera in the field of linguistics and literature, and she was in the Spanish department at the University of New Mexico. And just as we were just trying to compare notes and figure out what's going on here in New Mexico, I had gotten a call from this producer from National Public Radio out of New York, and he said he had heard a little bit about what we're doing, and he wanted to do a radio show on it for NPR. And we said, "No, that you can't do that. You're going to scare everyone away. It's just not going to work. You're going to intrude into people's lives, and it's just going to be a disaster." And we went around and around, and ultimately he said, "Well, you know, we're going to do this program whether." Whether you're going to cooperate with us or not. And so Tomas, Rowena, and I kind of huddled together and we said, "Well, I guess the only thing worse than doing it would be not doing it." So we sat down with Ben Shapiro and Nan Rubin, his collaborator. And we said, "All right, we'll cooperate under three conditions. Number one, we have a final review of the script. Number two, we serve as your consultants. And number three, you don't reveal the names of anyone who doesn't want their name revealed." And much to our surprise, they said, "Yeah, sure, these conditions are fine with us." And you know, Susan, it was, they turned out such a beautiful product. And instead of driving people away, it stimulated such interest among people within the Hispano community here in New Mexico and throughout the Southwest that we started getting calls from all over the place. And that, rather than stifled the discussion, it just seemed to encourage it.
I remember that. I remember, I think I even might have a tape of that interview with now that you bring it up. So, you know, over the last 20 years or so since my uninvolvement, interesting way of putting it, has this, you know, the interest seemed to grow even more, or are people still leery about communicating about it, or, you know, has anything really changed?
Well, the answer to both questions is yes. People have been a lot more open about it, and people have been a lot more leery about it. And there are also people from within and the Hispano community within the Jewish community that indicate to us that there's no such thing as Crypto Judaism. We're making all this up. Some of the people who are acknowledging a Jewish past are making up a past that they never had, so they can deny their blackness and their Indianness, and so they can climb the social ladder in New Mexico by claiming to be Jews.
Well, I guess they're pundits in all areas of the world, but. You know, Stan, you know, the cemeteries. I mean, they're just, you know, they're monuments that are indicative of, you know, something that exists there. I mean, you know, you and I walked many a cemetery, I think, in Albuquerque and other places in New Mexico, where some of the quote-unquote crypto-Jews were buried. And, you know, they had symbols on these tombstones that were indicative of Kohanim and Levites. And, you know, I mean, and the fact that they were Jews. And, I mean, they were there. I mean, there.
Well, one, of course, has to be very careful about jumping to unwarranted conclusions. And just because you see a six-pointed star on a cemetery doesn't necessarily indicate a sign of Judaism. As my colleagues in the field of anthropology and material culture tell me, objects do not speak for themselves. Everything has to do with context. And, of course, they're absolutely right. And sometimes a six-pointed star is just a six-pointed star, and other times when it's associated with a cultural recognition on the part of the family that put it there, the six-pointed star becomes the Star of David. And I'll give you an example of my own little journey of consciousness and understanding. In preparation for the book that you cited, To the End of the Earth, The History of the Crypto-Jews of New Mexico, I had engaged the contract services of a Sephardic material culture specialist from Miami, whose name is Annette Fromm. And I took her to one of these cemeteries, and I showed her a headstone that where the woman's first name was Esther. And in Hebrew, it had the Hebrew name Esther Bat Yosef, Esther the daughter of Joseph, and with the Hebrew letters Peinun, meaning here lies, and then the acronym in Hebrew for may her soul be bound in the bonds of eternal life. And in the center of this was a very prominent six-pointed star. And so I said, see what this indicates? Is this a Jewish stone or what? And she said, objects do not speak for themselves. You need to find out the context. You need to talk to the family. So to make a very long story short, we identified the brother of the young woman who was buried in the cemetery, who had passed on some 30 some years earlier. And the brother said, oh yeah, you know, we put that headstone there. My mom put the headstone there as a sign of the family's Jewish heritage. And so then that's when that six-pointed star turned into a Star of David. The same sort of thing in other six-pointed stars that we've seen in one of the churches in Albuquerque. There are two six-pointed stars very clearly indicated over the altar in the little two little cornices that hold up the altar. The altar had been reconstructed around the turn of the 20th century, somewhere around between 1900 and 1903. And, you know, I had always made the assumptions that these six-pointed stars obviously had something to do with Judaism. But it wasn't until I spoke with several informants who were parishioners of that church, who indicated to me that their grandparents, their aunts and uncles, their great-aunts and uncles had told them that the six-pointed star was there as the Star of David to represent the Judaism in the community. Again, that's when the six-pointed star became something more than just a six-pointed star.
But there are other symbols, too, that we saw that I remember you pointing out to me.
Yeah, there were Hebrew letters. There was there were menorahs. There was a symbol that looked very much like the Hebrew letter Shin. And again, it's just it could just be the exaggerated stamen of a flower, but when the family member takes you through the cemetery and say, this exaggerated stamen of the flower with its three prongs to us indicates the Hebrew letter Shin, which stands for Shaddai or the Almighty, again, that's when the stamen becomes more than a stamen, it becomes a Hebrew letter.
Now, I mean, I do remember, I mean, not everybody's tombstone was like this, but I mean, you know, you'd go by and you'd see a Solomon Lopez and a, you know, Isaac Romero and, I mean, just, you know, and then these are not real names. I'm just using them because that's what I remember them appearing like. But, I mean, you know, there was something on almost every one of these tombstones that was indicative of some connection to Judaism.
Mm-hmm. So, right, and the Jewish biblical first names are particularly interesting to me, because prior to the 1830s and 40s, you almost never see these names appearing in census records or documents or anywhere. And it isn't until the death of the Inquisition with the independence of Mexico in 1821 that makes it a little bit less culturally difficult to come out and stick a little toe out of the closet. But it's after the invasion of New Mexico by the United States forces in 1846 and the annexation of the entire what is today the U.S. Southwest, including New Mexico, as part of the United States, that's when you start seeing a proliferation of these Jewish biblical names in places like New Mexico. And, you know, as a test, I was wondering whether this could have been something that was true not only in New Mexico, but part of Old Mexico as well. There could have been something culturally going on within the Catholic Church that would have encouraged or permitted the use of these names. But I compared the proliferation of Jewish biblical names here in New Mexico with the names in Mexico City or even right across the border into Ciudad Juarez. And those names, you see almost zero Jewish biblical names in Mexico City and even in Ciudad Juarez through the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s. And it isn't until the beginning of the 20th century that you start seeing names like Abraham, Jacobo, Isaac, Moises, Salomon, Sarah, Rebecca, Raquel, these sorts of names show up south of the border. So something was going on here in New Mexico that was, I think, unique.
And I don't know the story, and I guess one of my trips needs to be down to Matamoros to, check into who my great grandfather was selling ice to down there. But if I remember correctly, we discussed too that there was at one point a very large crypto-Judaic population in Matamoros. Did we not?
Well, I've not studied that part of Mexico and that part of Texas, but it would not surprise me.
Right.
Because there was a very substantial crypto-Jewish population in the province of Nuevo León in the late 16th, early 17th centuries. And I would imagine that there would have been a significant migration from Nuevo León up to that part of Texas.
So, you know, going back a little bit more in history, just for, I guess, everybody's understanding, the Inquisition was in the 1400s, 1492, I think, is the year that stands out for all of us.
Actually, it was started and institutionalized in Spain in the 1480s.
Okay. I was going to... 1492 is the year that us non-historians have in our brain.
that was a very important year.
Right. And so in 1492, the Jews dispersed out of Spain, or they converted to Catholicism. And some of them left, and that's, you know, a lot of them populated the Europe and Eastern Europe during those times. But when did the migration really come into what is now Mexico?
Well, that ask his historian a historical question. He or she is probably going to go back a couple of centuries, but I'll try to be real brief about that.
Okay.
But we know that in 1492 there were several hundred thousand Jews living in Spain. And of those several hundred thousand Jews, we know that about half, as you say, left to countries where they could practice their Judaism openly. Some went right across the border into Portugal, some went north to France, some went east to Italy. A tremendous number went even farther east to the countries that were dominated by the Ottoman Empire, what is today Greece and Turkey, and the Balkan areas, and North Africa, and the Middle East. And it's these people that formed what we now know as the Sephardic Jewish diaspora. And chances are pretty good that of your listeners who are of Sephardic origin, that an awful lot of these folks will trace their origins back to this migration. So about half left. But we also know that about half of the several hundred thousand Jews that were living in Spain at the time decided for whatever reason to convert to Catholicism. Now we have to understand that many of these people who converted did so sincerely. and they just felt that this was a new program, and they were going to get on with it, and within two or three or four generations, these people just assimilate and acculturate into mainstream Spanish Catholic society, and we never hear from these people again. But we also know that many of these people who accepted baptism did so in name only, and despite outwardly practicing, professing Catholicism within the privacy and the secrecy of their homes, they practiced their ancient Judaic rites. And they did so at tremendous personal risk to themselves, because they're developed within the Spanish Catholic Church at the end of the 15th century an institution known as el Santo Oficio de la Inquisición, the Holy Office of the Inquisition. Now, contrary to what many of us learned in Sunday school, the Inquisition had no jurisdiction over Jews. The Inquisition was that institution formed within the Spanish Catholic Church that was entrusted to make sure that these people who said that they were Catholic were actually practicing good Catholicism. Now, if you go to Mass, if you and take communion, you do all the things that Catholic people do, and then you go back home and practice a different religion, in the eyes of the Catholic Church, you're not being a very good Catholic, right?
Right.
And so at the beginning, at the end of the 15th century, the beginning of the 16th century, the Holy Office of the Inquisition took its responsibilities very seriously. And all over Spain, thousands of people were arrested, tried, and convicted of practicing what the church regarded as la ley muerta de Moisés, the dead law of Moses. Life became very difficult for these cripto judíos, these crypto Jews, these secret Jews. Well, 1492 is an interesting year. We see the Christian armies defeat the southernmost Muslim kingdom of Granada, sending the Muslim armies packing across the Straits of Gibraltar. On March 31st, 1492, as you indicated, Fernando and Isabel, the Catholic monarchs of Spain, issued that infamous decree ordering that all the Jews in their realms had to either convert or leave. Well, what else happens in 1492?
Don't ask me. I'm.
Thanks. Well, you certainly must know what else happens in 14.
Oh, well, Christopher Columbus discovered
it. It was in all the papers, Susan. It was in all the papers. Christopher Columbus uncovered an entire new world for European eyes. And among the many thousands of Europeans to take advantage of these new opportunities in this, quote, new world, unquote, came a large number of these crypto Jews. As we've seen, the push factors are very strong. But the pull factors were also very strong, because what we have to remember is that, by and large, most of the people that we're talking about here tended to be pursuing mercantile occupations in one way, shape, or form. Most of these people tended to be merchants, following the same occupational patterns as their forebears. And in this new world, such that the Americans represented, there were tremendous opportunities to be had, not only as sources of raw material, but as markets for European goods. And in the beginning of the 16th century and expanding through the 17th and 18th century, we see the development and expansion of transatlantic, transpacific, and even trans-Indian Ocean commercial networks that were dominated by crypto-Jewish extended family circles, whereby an uncle in Madrid or Seville would send goods on consignment to a nephew in Mexico City. And in turn, that nephew would send those goods down to South America, Central America, to the Pacific, and up to the northern mining areas and exchange them for cacao or indigo or gold and silver. And because of the much-needed goods and services that these crypto-Jewish merchants were bringing into this frontier area, the policy on the part of the Spanish colonial officials in places like Mexico tended to be one more of toleration than persecution, relative to what's happening back in the old country, in that everyone seemed to know what these people were doing, they just seemed not to care very much. But, of course, there were two terribly important periods of persecution that were exceptional but very, very concentrated, one in the 1580s and 90s and another in the 1640s, which resulted in a flight from where the Inquisition was most active, that is to say Mexico City, into the northern mining areas and ultimately up to places like Texas, New Mexico, and even Arizona. And because the farther away you got from the centers of authority, the safer it was to be practicing your Judaism, even though you're doing it secretly.
And then
Did I answer a question you didn't ask? I usually do.
Yeah, but
that.
It was really very interesting. Because, you know, I mean, I was following another, when I started doing my genealogy, there was an Isaac Rodriguez Marquez, who was in the shipping business, and he was bringing goods and services, I guess, from Spain down through the Caribbean islands, and you know, I think he may have even been a slave trader of sorts.
Hey, Susan, my new book is on crypto use settlement in the Spanish Caribbean islands. So after we hang up, I want to talk to you about all this stuff. Maybe you can give me some leads.
Okay. Well, I can give you some leads. There's a lot of interesting things going on down in the Jewish Caribbean communities. And there is quite a nice size communities down there. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, that's what I'm finding. I've been doing some research in places like Havana and Santo Domingo and San Juan and Kingston, as well as Mexico, Lima, and Sevilla, and finding some very, very interesting stories on the part of crypto Jewish families who just settled there in the 1490s and just stayed, and other families that kind of came and went.
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, a lot of my New Orleans family that I discussed earlier also went down to Havana a lot for vacations.
Uh-huh.
So there must have been something there.
Well, New Orleans was subject to the governor in Havana all the way from the 1760s all the way until the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. New Orleans was governed by Havana.
Right, but I mean, I'm talking about, you know, my grandparents and great grandparents.
Yeah, but yeah, and what I'm suggesting is that these cultural ties kind of remain throughout the centuries.
Right. So I would suspect that there is quite a bit there.
I'm pretty sure you're absolutely right.
Well, you know, pretty soon you might be able to go there without having to go roundabout. Or
well,
if you want, I have some sailing buddies. They could probably get you over there.
They take you up on that.
I am trying not to be facetious. I needed a couple of good laughs.
Right.
Stressful week, I think, with the holidays coming up. So let's go, you know, going back to the migration. So around what time did a lot of these crypto Jews or end up in Mexico?
Well, we know that there were descendants of crypto Jews who were involved even with the Cortez expedition of 1580. 1519 to 1521, and there were two crypto Jews who were convicted of practicing Judaism even in the 1520s.
Okay.
Hernando Alonso and Diego de Ocaña, and because one was on the right side of the government, the other was on the other side of the government. One was burned at the stake, and the other was let off with a slap on the wrist. Indicative of the phenomenon that so often the Inquisition was used for political purposes, and some people were treated very severely, and other people were treated very leniently, just depending on what side of government favor that they were on.
So, when the New World, you know, some of the crypto Jews then migrated then from Mexico to what is now the Southwest, the New Mexico, Arizona, maybe even bits of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
When was that? I'm just trying to time period.
The critical year was 1580.
Okay.
And in 1580, by a crisis of succession, Philip II of Spain. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. By a crisis of succession in 1580, Philip II of Spain took over Portugal. And the life in Portugal from 1497, when they had to submit to their own forced conversion and expulsion, from 1497 until 1580, the relative to what was happening in Spain, the policy was one that was very, very tolerant. Now, all that changed in 1580 when Spain took over Portugal, and we see the Inquisition revived in Portugal with a vengeance. We see a remigration of these Spanish, now Portuguese, crypto Jews back to Spain, and a very large migration of these Portugueses, of these Portuguese crypto Jews, to Mexico. And a number of them settled in a place that was called El Nuevo Reino de León, or the Kingdom of Nuevo León, which is today where Monterrey and Tampico are today in northeast Mexico. And it was settled and governed by a grandson of converted Jews, a man by the name of Luis de Carvajal. And Luis de Carvajal was responsible for recruiting about 125 converso colonists from various parts of Spain and Portugal. And everything seemed to be going fairly well over there for this new colony until something happened. And that something happened had everything to do with the activities of Luis de Carvajal's nephew, whose name also just to confuse us was Luis de Carvajal. When this young teenager was told of his Judaism, he didn't react the same way the other kids did. The other kids said, hey, thanks for letting me know, I'll keep it under wraps. When young Luis de Carvajal was told of his Judaism, he said, if I'm going to be a Jew, I'm going to live openly as a Jew. And not only did young Luis de Carvajal try to live openly as a Jew, he tried to reconvert other conversos back to Judaism. Now, even in a tolerant environment such that Mexico represented in the 16th century, you couldn't get away with something like that. And young Luis de Carvajal had crossed over that line of acceptability and now posed a very serious threat to the moral fabric of Mexican society. And the Inquisition, that was just recently established as a formal tribunal in 1571, just 10 years earlier, came down like a ton of bricks, not only over the Carvajal family, but all the crypto Jews in Mexico. And all over Mexico, hundreds of people were arrested, tried, and convicted of practicing Judaism. Young Luis de Carvajal was convicted of practicing Judaism. He was slapped on the wrist and told to go into society and sin no more. But he was not made of such stuff. Immediately upon his release from jail, Luis de Carvajal immediately resumed his proselytizing activities. He was rearrested, convicted of relapsing into his heresy, and was burned at the stake in the Alto de Fe of 1596, along with several members of the community and several members of his family. Now, his uncle, you remember the governor, was not at all happy with the activities of his nephew. You're going to get us all in trouble, he said. And he indeed got them all in trouble. And the governor was arrested and sent down to Mexico City, where he died. Now, he left behind in Nuevo León a lieutenant governor by the name of Gaspar Castaño de Sosa. And as soon as Castaño found out what happened to his boss back in Mexico City, he panicked, he organized the remaining European settlers in Nuevo León and headed into uncharted territory, headed north to the Rio Grande, up the Rio Grande to its confluence with the Pecos River, up the Pecos to its headwaters, across Glorieta Pass in New Mexico, and then right around halfway between what is today Albuquerque and Santa Fe. He tried to establish what he was hoping would become the first permanent European colony in what is today the U.S. Southwest. And there's only one thing wrong with what he tried to do. Under the terms of Spanish colonial policy, you can't just go off on an expedition of your own. You needed to get permission from the authorities. And he didn't do it. He just went off and left. Now, when the viceroy in Mexico City found out what happened to him, they sent a military expedition northward, arrested Castaño, and brought the whole party back to central Mexico. Most of the survivors of the Castaño de Sosa expedition went back to Nuevo León, and they tried to pick up their earlier lives. And it's no small coincidence that today, some of the descendants of the original colonists from this Castaño de Sosa expedition are now exploring their own Jewish heritage, and they're beginning to talk a little bit about their own Jewish origins. And, of course, there was a significant migration ultimately from Nuevo León up into Texas. But most of this, there were other survivors of the Castaño de Sosa expedition that were just hanging around central Mexico, terribly fearful that the Inquisition was going to find them and do terrible things to them. And so right around that time, the viceroy in Mexico City decided that maybe it wouldn't be a bad idea to establish a colony on the far northern frontier in Santa Fe, or near Santa Fe in northern New Mexico. And he entrusted this task to a man named Juan de Oñate. And among the first people that Oñate went to recruit for this expedition were the survivors of the Castaña de Sosa expedition. They knew the route, they knew the territory. These people could help Oñate establish this new colony on a much more firm footing. And you can imagine the reaction on the part of some of these survivors when here comes this guy saying, hey, who wants to go to the end of the earth with me? And they're raising their hand, looking over their shoulders, saying, yeah, take me, I'd be happy to go. Now, when you look at the list of the warrants for the arrests that the inquisitors had back in the 1590s, and you compare them with the muster roll of the Oñate expedition coming north, you find some very interesting things. You find that not only did some of these soldiers and colonists have the same names, but their parents had the same names, and they had come from the same hometown back in Spain and Portugal. And as part of my research for To the End of the Earth, I was able to do genealogical research on several of the Oñate colonists, as well as several of the colonists coming north with Castaño just a couple of years earlier, and I was able to find that several of them were able to trace their families back to Jewish and crypto-Jewish families in Mexico, Spain, and Portugal. Clear indications from the documentation that among the first settlers of the first European colony in what is today the United States, among these settlers could be found a number of these crypto-Jews. Do I believe that they were all crypto-Jews or the majority were crypto-Jews? Absolutely not. But I could. What the documentation does tell us that among these settlers we could find some of these crypto-Jews or descendants of crypto-Jews. So a long-winded way of answering your question, some of these crypto-Jews found their way into what is today the U.S. Southwest as early as the 1590s, and there were others that trickled up on the mercantile routes from central Mexico to New Mexico through the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries as well.
Now, how does this crypto-Judaic migration relate to the Native American Indian? Yeah, one of the things that I am finding is, as I take on caseloads, that there are a lot of people trying to either prove or, you know, have Native American bloodline, so to speak. And, you know, how did these overlap, or did they overlap, or?
Well, what I found is that the people who I was able to identify as crypto Jews tended to marry other crypto-Jews.
Okay.
When I did my doctoral dissertation on the crypto-Jewish community of Mexico, I found that these folks were endogamous. That is to say, they married inside the group 95% of the time. And I'm finding the very similar patterns develop with the people who I've identified as descendants of crypto-Jews in New Mexico. They tended to marry each other. And that, of course, meant if they're marrying each other, they're marrying less into Native American groups.
Okay.
So I'm not seeing an awful lot of marriage between crypto-Jews and Native American groups in New Mexico.
Okay. Well, that answers that question, doesn't it?
Well, that's one answer. You may find someone else who you might invite on your show to say they found something completely different, but that's not what my research is showing.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned here about some, you know, your next book. Obviously, you're taking this, you know, multiple generations down the line. I mean, this has been your life's work. I mean, I don't think you've done much since... When did you get your dissertation and PhD?
1980, yeah.
So, I mean, you pretty much have, this is pretty much your life's work.
It is, but I also, I lead an interesting life. I also run a historical consulting firm, and I do historical research as it pertains to land rights and water rights here in New Mexico. And oftentimes I'm called upon by various parties in lawsuits to do research that ends up with testimony in court. So I spend about 80% of my time on the consulting and about 80% of my time on the crypto Jews. So I find it's a pretty good balance.
That's a great balance. I,
That works for me.
Yeah, and I have to acknowledge the tremendous influence over my career of my mentor, Richard Greenleaf, who is the France B. Scholes endowed chair of history over at Tulane University in the Center for Latin American Studies. And he was an inspiration for me both in terms of research into the crypto Jews as well as the importance of historical research to solving present problems in land and water rights.
Well, you know, since we started late, we still have some time left, and I got so engrossed I forgot to give out the number to see if anybody has any questions for you, so I'm going to do that before the hour is up. I think we've got maybe about 10 more minutes. And the number is 888-815-9756. If you have any questions for Dr. Hortis or Stanley, as I call him, give us a call. It's really interesting information. And as you mentioned, I mean, you know, there are going to be pundits just as there are pundits about anything that goes on in this world that, you know, things didn't happen. And I think as I mentioned to you on the telephone before the show that, you know, there are people that don't believe that the Holocaust happened. It doesn't matter. I mean, you know, you have to, when you research these kinds of things and you begin to see these kinds of things and, you know, you talk to the people that are involved, you can't dismiss it. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, you can if you just want to globally dismiss something. But
I obviously am not going to disagree with you here, but you know, sometimes I think the good Lord put historians on this earth to disagree with one another. And the only thing I can tell your readers is to read my work and read their work and make their own choices. There is a wonderful new book that's just out a couple of months ago by my colleague in anthropology whose name is Seth Kunin, K-U-N-I-N, who spent 10 years spending his summers here in New Mexico with the descendants of crypto Jews, and he has written a wonderful book called Juggling Identities, Identity and Authenticity Among the Crypto Jews, also published by Columbia University Press in 2009. You can find it in bookstores everywhere. Well, maybe not everywhere, but you can get it on Amazon for sure. Or ask your local bookstore to order it from Columbia University Press. And what Seth Kunin's book does is he deals with the whole question of identity today. And Susan, even though he lives and works in England, I think he would be a tremendous interview for your show because he can talk with so much greater authority about what's happening today among the descendants of these crypto Jews, their faith choices, their spiritual journeys, you know, and he's able to analyze things that I could only dream of doing.
I will get his contact information from you. Yes, I read his name down. I had that in my head before you mentioned it. So I would love to speak with him. I think it would be a wonderful addition to the shows. Actually, let's talk a little bit. You mentioned that if anybody was interested in joining the Crypto Judaic Society, is it open to anyone? Is it?
It is open to everyone. There's no pedigree or no degree that you need to own in order to join. And you can join. You can look at our website at www.cryptojews.com. That's www.cryptojews.com. And there you'll find the Society for Crypto Judaic Studies website. We urge you to join. We urge you to, we have a wonderful couple of publications, Halapid, which discusses current issues among crypto Judaism. And then there's a scholarly journal that is just, has its first issue published out of Florida International University called the Journal of Spanish, Portuguese, and Italian Crypto Jews. And you can find information on both of these publications on this website.
Now, and I believe, too, we worked a couple of years ago, there is a database on Jewish Gen, is there not?
All the research that I did into, well, let me back up a little bit. What I did for as part of the research for To the End of the Earth, I selected 9 sample families here in New Mexico who either knew something about the crypto Judaism in their family, or they were unfortunate enough to suffer from one of these diseases that I was talking about earlier. And I was able to interview the 9 individuals, and then I was able to trace their families as far back as I could to ascertain the extent to which their families could be linked to crypto-Jewish or Jewish families back in Spain, Portugal, Mexico, France, and even Italy. And I turned over all of my data to Jewish Gen. So if you log on to jewishgen.org and follow the individual links, you should be able to get to my database.
Well, I remember
it's
doing
no,
that.
It's by no means comprehensive. These are just the family histories of the 9 families that I was able to do research on.
Right. Now, I had another question that I lost in my brain. Don't you love it?
When's the last time you saw it?
Well, when you were talking about the database on Jewish Gen, I was there. Hold on a second. I'm going to give myself just a minute and see if it'll come back. DNA. Is there a DNA project that started on what you all are doing, or?
Well, that's another interesting question that's going to require probably more time than we have remaining, but my understanding is that there is an organization called Family Tree DNA out of Houston, Texas.
Right.
By Bennett Greenspan.
Bennett was one of my first guests on the show. I think he was number 4.
Yep. Well, so I don't need to tell your listeners about Bennett's work, but what intrigues me even more than Bennett's work is the question of diseases, and the research that's being done as we speak into the genetics aspects of certain diseases and genetic mutations that are being found among some of the communities and families in the Southwest today. For example, there is a genetic mutation called 187-DEL-AG, also known as the BRCA, BRCA1 mutation, that's associated with breast and ovarian cancer. And I'm certainly no geneticist, so I'm just relating to you what my colleagues in that field are telling me, that this genetic mutation is associated very strongly with Jewish families. And for whatever reason, in various pockets in New Mexico and southern Colorado in Hispanic communities, they're finding large concentrations of individuals who sadly have contracted, been diagnosed with breast and ovarian cancer, who, upon having blood tests done, reveal this genetic mutation. And geneticists and anthropologists and genetic counselors are working with people in these communities to identify people at risk, and those people who are at risk, they're being urged to get early diagnosis and thus early treatment.
Interesting. We have a caller actually on line one. Let's take it. His name is David.
No, Susan. Hi, this is Daniel Horowitz from Israel.
Oh, Daniel, hi. How are you?
Hear you. Thank you very, very much. I'm very, very good.
Good. You know Dr. Hortis, then, I take it.
I don't know in person, and actually I've been listening to your program, and it's very, very interesting, especially because I'm planning to do a month trip to the west coast of the United States, and I didn't hear about the meetings that the crypto Jews organizations have over there. Do they have monthly meetings, and how can I contact them?
Stan, let me. Daniel is on the board of the International Association of Jewish Genealogical Societies. He's also with MyHeritage.com and was a guest about a month or so ago. And he's from South America, Argentina, correct?
Venezuela.
Venezuela. I knew I was going to get that wrong. Stanley, you can answer his question now. I just wanted to let you know who he was.
If you could repeat the question, I didn't hear it clearly.
Yes, I know that there are different groups of crypto Jews or genealogy organizations, but how can we get in contact, and if you have like monthly meetings? I will be visiting the West Coast during the month of June and July, and I would love to go to one of those meetings and maybe lecture over there.
Well, Daniel, the only thing I can tell you is that the folks within the crypto Jewish community meet without historians and without journalists and without anyone else, kind of interfering in their discussions. So I'm not privy to when they meet and where they meet. The only thing I can tell you is the more academic, more scholarly organizations, such as the New Mexico Jewish Historical Society and the Society for Crypto Judaic Studies. They do hold regular annual conferences. The Society for Crypto Judaic Studies conference will be taking place in San Antonio, Texas, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. And accessing the website www.cryptojews.com will, as the plans for that meeting develop, that information will be posted on the website. And we would certainly invite you to submit an abstract for consideration at that meeting, if you can.
Excellent. Thank you very, very much. I will visit the website, and I will look for more information over there.
And, Daniel, if you have any more questions, feel free. You know how to reach me. And I will certainly pass it on to Stan.
Thank you very, very much.
All right.
Nice to meet you on the air.
Yep. He's my heritage is actually out of Israel, so he was calling live from Israel.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? Yes. From Venezuela, calling from Israel. So we have listeners all over the world. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
I said it's probably 10 at night over there.
It is. Well, I think that we have used up our hour. We used up a few minutes trying to find you with your broken phones, but in any event, Stan, I appreciated it. Very enlightening. Once again, refresh your course for me. I know I've heard all this stuff before, many years ago. And
it's certainly a pleasure.
I do remember a couple pieces of my history.
Well, Susan, it's been a pleasure being your guest on the air, and invite me back to talk about the Caribbean project in a couple of years once I finish with it.
Okay. Well, we will stay in touch for sure.
Terrific.
And we might be able to point you in some directions.
Great. Come visit me in Albuquerque.
I might do that. I have a friend in Santa Fe, and you never know what I may do these days.
Well, I'll leave the porch light on.
I can find it. Stan, thanks again.
Everybody,
thank you. What an enlightening conversation. It just fascinates me, and I've been fascinated with it for many years. In any event, next week, after we get through in the United States, Turkey Day on Thursday, we have Noah Tudak, who is with Genie.com. Most of you know that is one of the premier social networks for genealogy. And he's going to be explaining and talking about what they are doing and what their mission and goal is. And on December 8th, we have Alexander Beiter back for a repeat performance. If anybody is interested in asking Sasha any questions about their Slavic surnames, please go to www.susaneking.com into the forum, and that is where you will need to ask those questions. So everybody have a wonderful weekend, holiday weekend, to be safe in your travels, and we'll see you next Tuesday where Genealogy and Spirit connect.